has everybody sat and tried to read out loud for 2 hours?
Yeah.
It's not an easy task to do. Give this man a hand. He is laying it on us. It looks easy, but it is not an easy task. And he's explaining everything as he goes along. What a wonderful job. Hey, I got an interesting phone call after we got started today from my wife. You're not going to believe what she was asking me. I can't find a cat.
All 13?
No, just one. Remember I said there was one missing? She said, I can't find the cat. And she calls, did you let the cat out? I just, But she hung up and she finally called back. She said, oh, I finally found the cat. So it wasn't the one that was in the marinade last night. Anyway, I invited her down to tell the story. I don't know if she'll make it or not. I thought it was really interesting. So you ready to get through the afternoon?
Yes, sir.
We're all ready?
Yes.
How ready are you?
Ready.
I need to hear some noise to get... He needs some motivation. He's been sitting here. He needs some motivation. You got to raise it up a little bit. Raise it up. Okay. Wow. Mark, I don't know. I think you need a little more motivation. What do you think?
No, I'm fine.
You good motivation? Okay. Before we get started, I got a quick question. Where is the notebook with all the names and addresses on it for the mailing? Who has that? Okay. Thank you very much. One more time. Get it up for Mark. We'll get started.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah.
Dennis, let me know when you want me to roll.
We're rolling now.
Oh, okay. Sorry about that. All righty. I guess the camera's rolling. So we left it off at the top of the page. So thus far, we pretty much addressed what they've been doing or what they have not been doing. And we're continuing along supporting our position, if you want to call it a position, because they call it a frivolous position. And as you recall, the definition of frivolous is a rational argument or reasonable argument or whatever. I think we've been pretty reasonable thus far. And we have a little bit more reason to show them. The canon of construction which teaches that legislation of Congress, unless a contrary intent appears, is meant to apply only within the territorial jurisdiction of the United States. Remember, we have transited from state. They admitted they're actually talking about some federal income tax. So now we're saying, well, wait a minute, what is it that you're doing about the federal income tax? Because we don't see anywhere where the state would have any power or any jurisdiction within the states. And these are further support of those footnotes. And we're bringing this forward because it's pretty clearly stated, and it's a Supreme Court. Those not familiar with abbreviations, whenever after a case, after the V United States, for example, you see 284 U.S., that's a Supreme Court. And after that follows an SCT, that's short for Supreme Court. All right, and the following on the bottom is 1949 year, Supreme Court, 1949. No interference by Congress with the business of citizens transacted within a state is warranted by the Constitution. There we go. We asked that before. Can the Constitution, can Congress do anything that's not constitutional? Can they pass any statutes? Well, if they have no business, no transactions, no nothing, as warranted by the Constitution, one goes, without the other, except such as is strictly incidental to the exercise of powers clearly granted to the legislature. Bill? We kind of concluded that those powers granted to the legislature when it comes to United States are directly to the states and international commerce of some sort, and they don't apply directly to the people. Isn't that what we concluded?
The governments derive their powers from the Constitution, which was derived from the people. So the preamble for the U.S. Constitution says that we, the people, ordain and establish this Constitution for them, not for us. So that tells me that they can make any rule they want for themselves. But I don't see how they can make it for us. And that's that sovereign relationship. However, they came up with this new classification, new type of human being called citizen of the United States. And a citizen of the United States is someone who is subject to the United States, to the jurisdiction. So if you're a citizen of the United States, then they can make rules for you. If you're a citizen, or if you're not a citizen, if you're one of the people, they cannot make rules for you. So that's the distinction. You know?
Yeah, perfect. Thank you.
Well, that was a segue to the second part of this paragraph, because it says, thus limited, so there is some limitation, and Bill just pointed out, which they admit there is some limited, this limited, and thus only, it reaches every subject. And if you look at the 14th Amendment, subject is the operative word. So it reaches every subject and may be exercised at discretion. So they have basically, this is telling us, a lot of liberty to do whatever they want to their own subjects. But it reaches only existing subjects. Ah, okay, thank you. For those back there. It reaches only existing subjects, right? Congress cannot authorize a trade or business within a state in order to tax it. We saw that before. The recognition by the acts of Congress of the power and right of the state, the recognition by the acts of Congress of the power and right of the state to tax, control, or regulate any business carried on within its limits is entirely consistent with an intention on the part of Congress to tax such business for national purposes. What is alcohol, tobacco, and firearms tax? It has a right excise tax, and it has a national character. That's what this supports pretty much what we all know and believe to be true. Other restrictions are, of course, found in Article 1, Section 2 and 9, requiring direct taxes to be apportioned according to population. California earlier says that the income tax is not a direct tax on property. So if it were, it would have to be apportioned. I don't see graduated there. Then we have Section 8 requiring uniformity. Now that uniformity applies to states. And so the government can tax uniformly the states and the portion to the population as part of the Constitution. We're talking federal taxation here or there. Furthermore, Section 7851 of Title 26 USC reveals that the income taxes under Subtitle A were extinguished upon the enactment of the 1954 Code details, thank you, in Exhibit 83-page exhibit. Yeah, this will take a week. Anyway, to give you a little hint here, the 1954 code, Section 7851, identifies that the provisions in regards to Subtitle A would be valid from December 31st of 1953 until the enactment of this title, which is the 1954 code. And that title was enacted sometime in August, I believe was 16th or so, in August of 1954, and not beyond that. So those Subtitle A provisions were actually active for 9 months. And we have a whole exhibit about that. Further, and the IRS index lists only the liability of citizens with income from insular possessions. And that's part of that exhibit as well. Federal administrative office regulations are exercised under the limited jurisdiction found in Title 4 USC. So what does administrative office regulation pertain to? Well, administrative agency may not, under guise of its rulemaking power, abridge, or enlarge its authority or act beyond powers given it by statute, which is source of its power. Again, they have to have a source to act. But what did we discover earlier? What makes a difference? The regulations. And administrative regulations that alter or amend statute or enlarge or impair its scope are void. Does that mean I have to go out there and look up the statute and then check out the regulations? Well, not necessarily. Remember, in order for those regulations to apply to anybody, you must have some sort of liability controllable by particular regulations. Obviously, a regulation for some program that they put forth are going to be probably different, most likely, than some other program that they put forth. They just have the statutory jurisdiction over them, and they're highly specific, and they're supposed to be specific, as you will see later on stated in other cases. Also, those administrative office regulations are to be exercised under the limited jurisdiction found in Title 4 U.S.C., which explicitly states that in agreement with the Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17 in the Constitution, Title 4 U.S.C., Section 72, public offices at the seat of government, states, all offices attached to the seat of government shall be exercised in the District of Columbia and not elsewhere. Except as otherwise expressly provided by law. All right. But generally, not as well unless expressly provided by law. That's why I mean they have to be very specific. So when we go ask these questions, well, which statute, which regulation, we're not out of place. We're asking legitimate, you know, friendly questions. And 4 U.S.C. 70 is supported by another exhibit. I believe that's a 64-page exhibit. Then, and may create no liabilities. Those regulations may create no liabilities for people or the states. How do we know that? Because administrative agencies may not create a criminal offense or any liability not sanctioned by the lawmaking authority, specifically a liability for a tax or inspection fee. As Bill pointed out, well, if Congress has authority to make law, and Congress's subjects when it comes to humans would be its citizens, let's say, obviously that authority would be pertaining mostly or mainly to citizens, or let's say people that come in those program interactions within government purview. So for people, let's see how does it go for people. Neither branch of the legislative department, still less a merely administrative body, established by Congress, possesses or can be invested with a general power of making inquiry into the private affairs of the citizen. Now they're identifying a citizen here. Could this be a citizen before the Constitution? Could this be a citizen after the Constitution? Do we really care? No. Even if we were a citizen, this one pretty much says, you know, you're well protected here. Feel safe. And it cannot be too often repeated that the principles that embody the essence of constitutional liberty and security forbid all invasions on the part of government and its employees of the sanctity of man's home and the privacies of his life. Is my making a living somewhere part of my privacy of my life? Is my working from home privacy of my life? As said by Mr. Justice Field in of all the rights of the citizens, few are greater importance or more essential to his peace and happiness. Well, I didn't know happiness is a factor in their consideration, but it looks like it is. I'm in pursuit of happiness, so that's great. They recognize that. Then the right of personal security, and that involves not merely protection of his person from assault, but exemption of his private affairs. Me working, could that be a private thing or is that a public thing? Unless I maybe work for as a public official. That would not be private. So, hint, hint, franchise, public official. Books and papers from inspection and scrutiny of others. Without the enjoyment of this right, all others would lose half their value. Well, isn't that what they're looking for? 50% of what you make? No, it's a joke. All right, of the state. Now, how about can they create a liability for the state? But for a long time, this court has steadfastly adhered to the doctrine that the taxing power of Congress does not extend to the states or their political subdivisions. Then we move to California, back to FTB. So let me refresh your memory. This section here applies to the IRS communications. So we made the best of worlds, compromise this with so you can benefit right away from it. It's not perfectly adapted for your individual cases or anything. You have to do that. But you have enough ammunition here to address FTB specifically, excuse me, IRS specifically. It hears back in the same quotations as general power of the state and agents over people in the state jurisdiction. California Government Code, Section 54950, states, in enacting this chapter, the legislature finds and declares that the public commissions, boards, franchise tax board, and councils, and the other public agencies in this state exist to aid in the conduct of the people's business. There's a footnote for the state because California Revenue and Taxation Code definition, Section 6017, in this state, this is what you were talking about, Fred, earlier, in this state or in the state means within the exterior limits of the state of California and includes all territory within these limits owned by or ceded to the United States of America. Now, when I first... Understood. But when we read this, this is quoted in 54950, right? So 54950 exists today. So when we read that, what could within the exterior limits of the state of California and includes all territory within these limits owned or ceded? Within the exterior limits. Isn't that a roundabout way to say what? So what we think it means, and others support this, and we want to know, we're asking them, we think that you have interior limits of a border, you have the exterior limits of that border, but because if you have, for example, a federal territory inside California, you can't say the interior limits of the federal territory inside California. So what they did, they reversed whatever faces the state is interior limits, and whatever faces the federal territory is the exterior limits. So interior limits, exterior limits. So when you have a circle in the middle of California, interior limits to California state would be those facing the state of California, let's say, the geographical portion. And everything that's inside the circle are within the exterior limits of California, which now becomes a territory of the United States. And that's how we read this. Yes. We have a comment here.
There's an argument that the Buck Act created an overlay over all of the states so that all the states are considered to be federal territory and that all the states have a federal tax ID so that they're all really federal municipal corporations, which makes us all employees. Have you hit that argument?
Not in this general notice and demand.
Can I address that real quickly?
Okay, Fred wants it to whack up.
First executive order by George Washington on March 4th of 1791, he made a Buck Act overlay of all the original 13 states for the purpose and purpose only of collecting a whiskey excise tax. This is now found in one stat, page 200 through 206, of 1791, I think it was either one day before or one day after that executive order. Now, if this is true, they only have jurisdiction to collect an alcohol tax and not an income tax. So you're right on the Buck Act overlay. He made federal districts out of every one of the 13 new states, but only for that provision of collecting a whiskey excise tax, nothing else.
That's one of those specific powers. and that's why it is applicable. It is constitutional, and it does not conflict with what we were saying just a minute ago, that Congress does not have power to regulate over states, and especially within their legislature, unless within specific powers, and that's what Fred is pointing out. Does that answer the question?
Yes.
Great. Thank you. Thank you. Yes.
I think also in support of what you're saying is this is within exterior
limits.
Limits includes
yes
federal territory, meaning only
yes
federal territory. So no matter how you look at it, it's only the federal territory.
Yeah, I couldn't say it more clearly than they did, if we can consider that clear. I would have said inside that circle is federal, outside is California, but that's me. The means within the exterior limits of the state of California and includes all territory within these limits owned by or ceded to the United States of America. And here's a point. Do we see there United States of America?
Yes.
Good. Remember what Bill was saying? The preamble, we the people of the United States ordain and establish this for United States of America. Here it is identified as a specific territory separate from the state of California, right? And there's another, just to brush through this, we're not going to go in details. There's a difference between federal government and national government. And you find that in Black's Law Dictionary, 4th edition. And I chased that because I had a couple of questions in President Taft's speech or a presentation to the Senate. When he was proposing the 16th Amendment, and it appeared as he was saying the tax was placed upon the national government, but then in the end of his speech he said the power given to the federal government to place an income tax. And then when I looked up federal government versus national government, it appears that the federal government would be what we perceive as the coming together of the states of the Union under a federation, and the national government is the socialist national state that has jurisdiction over territories, citizenships, and stuff like that. That's what it appears at this point, and we're going to elaborate on that when we go into the nitty-gritty aspects of notice and demands. Yeah, this is a nitty-gritty law school, right? Not anymore. Law library. Okay, well, there you go. Thank you. It's not a school. This is not a school, Max. All right, thank you. Right, so out of the code, California Government Code section so on, so it says, exist to aid in the conduct of people's business. Now, here's what we say. Agents appear to replace exist to aid in the conduct of the people's business, which is right out of there, with exist to conduct people. Or exist to make demands, or exist to sanction. That's what I got from what they sent, that which you all have on your table. Constitutional canons bind government codes to specific jurisdiction, which cannot extend agents' authority over people making a living. We already addressed that. Fair share. In occupations of common right. Agents appear to conveniently presume or assume the existence of a trade or business, because we already established that trade or business is not taxable with inside the states for state revenue purposes in order to justify their allegations of a liability within agents' jurisdiction. That's why they're doing it. They're like, oh, we didn't notice you have a trade or business and whatever, therefore we have jurisdiction. Clearly, then, can be no legal sanction or penalty issued through unlawful imposition of agent's assumed jurisdiction. Penalty, says the statutory procedures, first of all, in order to become liable under statutory procedures, you have to voluntarily subscribe yourself to some of those programs. Reflect the obvious concern that there be no sanction or penalty imposed upon one because of his exercise of constitutional rights. Okay? Unlawful imposition. Unlawful imposition is defined in the Hobbs Act as extortion. Somebody said beforehand, it's extortion. Yes, that's exactly what it is. As the obtaining of property from another with his consent. not without extortion, is is obtaining property from another with his consent, induced by wrongful use of actual or threatened force, violence, or fear, or under color of official right. Anybody here receiving that letter with $20,000 penalties or imprisonment and all that would experience any smidgen of fear at all? Well, yeah, I mean, you know, I better respond. So we don't respond to that love letter because it actually is a love letter. We respond to it because we don't perceive it as love. We perceive it as you know, fearful implementation of psychological war games. I informed agents, exhibit so-and-so. We did about that. We told them a few words, kindly, and thanked them for it. That I retain all my rights. The right to contract is a constitutionally protected right and cannot be imposed. How do I know that? Well, the Internal Revenue Code is not positive law. It is special law. It applies to specific persons in the United States who choose to make themselves, I hate this, subject to the requirements of the special laws in the Internal Revenue Code by entering into an employment agreement with the United States government, U.S. government. The law is that income from sources not effectively connected with the conduct of a trade or business within the U.S. government is not subject to any tax under Subtitle A of the Internal Revenue Code. IRS Disclosure Officer. Okay. So we're saying the right to contract is a constitutionally protected right and cannot be imposed, forbidden, hindered, or diminished. The state cannot diminish rights of the people. Hurtado or hurtado, potato, potato, the people of the state of California. Legislators have no constitutional authority. What does that mean? Where rights secured by the Constitution are involved, there can be no rulemaking or legislation which would abrogate them. Is that pretty? If I were a legislator, I read that, I'd say, you know what? That's a Supreme Court. Yeah, I'm in the wrong business. Yeah, there's no legal plunder here. Okay, so they cannot do unconstitutional statutes, enact unconstitutional statutes. And this is another supportive point here. A statute does not trump the Constitution. All right? Or regulations that could grant agents an immoral, predatory license to generate revenue by use of complex administrative techniques and evasive replies. Nor can statutes allow wordsmith definitions and regulations to enable agents to act in ways in ways which could easily be construed as syndicated crimes, or to engage in legal violence to dupe people, or use legal strategies to bring even taxpayers in the position to prove a negative. Syndicated crimes. Let me put this up on the screen. A little higher. All right. So, syndicated crimes, let's see what that could be. A practice condemned by the Constitution cannot be saved by historical acceptance and present convenience. They've done this pretty historically by now. That doesn't make it, yeah, you know. All right. 1984. Ninth Circuit. Okay. So, or to engage in legal violence to dupe people. What would that be construed as? When a government agent acts in an unconstitutional manner, the agent becomes liable for damages. Oops, there goes that, what do we call that, immunity? Yeah, that's I believe that's a Supreme Court, 1970. You gotta love Supreme Court. So this one is key here. Legal strategies to bring even taxpayers in the position to prove a negative. Out of the horse's mouth. The taxpayer cannot be left in the unpardonable position of having to prove a negative.
But we're not taxpayers.
But that's why I said, even a taxpayer.
Yeah.
Right? So, even a taxpayer cannot be proven in a negative position. Okay, remember in this particular case, the guy says, look, I was away, I came back. Well, prove you did not make money. Isn't that proven negative position?
Let me get your paper.
prove you. Yeah, you got to show now how it is that you didn't make money. Let me think. Yes, I'll come up with some creative means of showing you that. Yeah, I can do it all with one finger. Agents have no authority to demand payments for imaginary, ambiguous, statutory privileges. What are those? The Constitutional Confrontation Clause has been held to prevail over a statutory privilege. Guess what? We're in the lead. The Constitutional Confrontation Clause has been held to prevail over a statutory privilege. So if a statute, even just a little bit, trespasses within our constitutional rights, or constitutionally protected rights, I should say, it's not valid. Well, they don't seem to take that into consideration. So they can't use legal violence or use legal strategies to bring taxpayers in that. Agents have no authority to demand payments for imaginary, ambiguous, statutory privileges. Why am I saying imaginary, ambiguous? Well, they say, well, you know, everybody has to pay taxes. You know, we have all these, you got to support the government, you got to do this, you got to... Okay, well, if as long as we believe that, then they can imply anything. And the statutory construction cannot be imaginary, cannot be ambiguous, has to be specific. All right, so why? Why is that rule there? Because agents have no authority to force people into accepting privileges, benefits, or services. No legislation can vote away people's rights and grant administrative authority to entrap, trick, intimidate, or compel people to either purchase or to provide services. Such acts would be racketeering or practicing slavery. Okay? So let's see how we supported these. Okay. To force people into accepting privileges, benefits, or services. Well, railroad benefits, we stated that before, like Social Security benefits, are not contractual and may be altered or even eliminated at any time. No legislation can vote away people's rights. Is that true? Well, one's right to life, liberty, and property, and other fundamental rights may not be submitted to vote. Not legislation. They may not even be considered as a voting issue. They depend on the outcome of no elections. It should make no difference. No water, no matter who takes power. You don't touch this, Bella. So, and grant administrative authority to entrap, trick, intimidate, okay, provide services. U.S. Constitution, Article 13. Neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as a punishment for a crime whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, shall exist within the United States. Also, in California Constitution Article 1, Declaration of Rights, slavery is prohibited. Involuntary servitude is prohibited except to punish crime, okay, like forced labor inside prison or something. And here again, who's going to say Constitution is not the law of the land? Who's going to say slavery has not been abolished? That's what we're going by. All right? Good. With freedom of choice as the guiding principle, it has been held that the element of voluntariness is vitiated under duress brought on by government action. Okay? That's Perlman v. U.S., Federal Second, and Court of Claims right here. Okay, and vitiated for them to give them a clarification. What that means is to impair the quality of or value of, to corrupt morally, to invalidate. And here comes the fact of little story when we start drawing conclusions, what it appears that they're doing to us. Each and every year, 2004 through the present, I asked agents for verified proof behind agents' allegations, presentments, penalties, determinations, or claims. Absent specific answers and verified evidence, I could not make any informed corrections. California Civil Code Section 3531 says, the law never requires impossibilities. So, honor and dishonor. We asked, you did not respond, yet you want me to perform in a certain way. I offered to make corrections,
You did not provide the information. You'd be asking for something impossible for me to comply with. Even if I had a duty, if I'm unclear about something, I have to be informed according to California government code. And I cannot assume, presume, or guess any liability for agents' ambiguous and misleading correspondence. Agents' letters lacked certified copies of verified debt, duty, liability, contract, or breach of a contract. Agents made no attempt to prove their jurisdiction, which we decided has to be on the record for administrative. And also, jurisdiction is essential to give validity to the determinations of administrative agencies. They made all those determinations. We determined you owe tax. And where jurisdictional requirements are not satisfied, the action of the agency is a nullity. Okay? Those are a couple of cases there, and California second right there. Or they didn't show a lawful reason for garnishing or not returning my funds. Some people are using like Pete Hendrickson's method and stuff like that. And they learn that they can use this form or that form, and if you write it this way or that way, you can get some of the money back. And what the IRS has done, FTB much less, to a much lesser degree, but the IRS has returned, has actually played along with those filings. And for a couple of years, the beginning 1 or 2 years, maybe even 3 years, they would send refunds. And now all those people that read the cracking the code of Pete Hendrickson are being are suffering this backlash or whiplash, whatever, of them coming back and saying, oh, we made an error, we send you the money in error, now you're going to pay that back, plus penalties, plus frivolous filings and stuff like that. And that's the game they play. So there's a possibility that they are liable for laches there because they intentionally allowed something to gain profit from later, because now on whatever they thought they owed, they can also tack on penalties plus interest, okay, which is much bigger amount. So, but we're not going to speculate. We're just postulating. As one of the people... did I jump over that one? No, okay. As one of the people, I'm owed answers. How do I know? Well, California government code. The people insist on remaining informed so that they may retain control over the instruments they have created. I am owed answers. That's presumptuous. Let's see. Is it? 5 U.S.C. 552A. The purpose of the act is to provide certain safeguards for an individual against invasion of personal privacy, to permit an individual to determine what records pertaining to him are collected, maintained, used, or disseminated by such agencies. It's only fair that I ask all these questions. I'm not aware of, nor have agents shown proof of any predicament that would subject me to comply with a specific statute and regulation related to agents' administrative authority, procedures, policies, notices, demands, or penalties. Predicament? What are we talking about? Living under a rule of law entails various suppositions, one of which is that all persons are entitled to be informed as to what the state commands or forbids. When they don't respond, when they're in dishonor, how can they claim anything? And then, penalties, 5 U.S.C. 556, except as otherwise provided by statute. The proponent of the rule, and this is we're citing the whole thing. In the previous citation, we only cited the first, but now we're going through the whole citation. A sanction may, the proponent of a rule or order has the burden of proof. A sanction may not be imposed or rule or order issued except on consideration of a whole record. Remember we said whole record and nothing but, or those parts thereof cited by a party and supported by and in accordance with a reliable, probative, and substantial evidence. Those are the elements, key elements of arriving at a determination. A party is entitled to present his case or defense by oral or documentary evidence, to submit rebuttal evidence, and to conduct such cross-examination as may be required for a full and true disclosure of the facts. How many people that have crossed swords with these guys ever got a cross-examination? None? Zero. Well, same here. No cross-examination. So here we have a strong indication that cross-examination is one of the key elements. So, well, I show you mine, you show me yours, kind of a situation. All right. So in light of all the exhibits and footnotes herein, Agents appear to operate an apparatus for control and profit, counter to constitutional oath, Supreme Court rulings, United States codes, civil code, business and professions code, Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, California government code. Notice the subtle language, not subtle, soft. Appear. Agents appear to operate. So we don't want to come across as we made up our mind, this is how it is, put them up. No, there's still room for negotiation. We're candidly proposing a negotiation. We're open to negotiations if you just prove all these things. However, in writing all these previous notices and demands, we kind of closed up the walls around them for them to have enough wiggle room to move forward. My letters gave agents sufficient notice of trespass due to lack of jurisdiction. And 99 here footnote says, it is now settled that when there is an issue as to the sufficiency of jurisdictional amount, the burden of providing jurisdiction is on the party asserting it. They're claiming they can write this letter to me and they can tell me what to do and whatever, right? Well, I think they are in disagreement with the Supreme Court. Look at the issue. Instead of bearing their burden of proof and disclosing all the elements, remember the elements are important, and say the burden of providing all of the essential elements thereof is upon the person so relying, them. And if one element is wanting, then the claim must fail. One element lacking, the claim must fail. Okay? Agents rushed to label my efforts as frivolous and to tack on penalties. Agents ignored my offers to settle the issues by mailing non-responsive replies. Remember we were saying what's non-responsive replies? Well, silence can only be equated with fraud. When there is a legal or moral duty to speak, or when an inquiry left unanswered would be intentionally misleading, we cannot condone this shocking conduct. If that is the case, we hope our message is clear. This sort of deception will not be tolerated, and if this is routine, it should be corrected immediately. U.S. v. Tweel, 1977 case. So I think that's recent enough, and they spoke loud and clear. Yeah, so that's why I like them, see? That's a good, I think they did good for us there. Okay, so, before I jump there, again, I'm readdressing now the issue of cross-examination. So first we addressed the need for cross-examination. Now we're showing that they didn't do it. Agents ignored my offers to settle the issue by mailing non-responsive replies to my inquiries and by ignoring my demands for verified evidence and cross-examination. And this gave me a chance to put another cross-examination reference, which says that minimum requirements of due process include to cross-examine and any opposing witness. You go to these hearings, this bum agent there, 104 IQ, whatever. No, I'm only here to take papers, and I cannot make any determination. And like I told you before, you receive 3 weeks later, receive a letter from Sacramento saying, based on his recommendations, we reached a 104 IQ determination. Agents' garnishments from my work are factual evidence of abuse due to the lack of liability. This is our punchline. Liability, jurisdiction, or an order by a court of competent jurisdiction. Basically, very subtly here, we are allowing them to think, okay, well, we can go to court, but we don't tell them what we consider a competent jurisdiction, a court of competent jurisdiction. And since you are familiar with 1215, you know what a competent jurisdiction means for us. Court of record, right? Agents appear to willfully misinterpret the statutes and regulations as a license to engage in predatory administrative technicalities instead of providing transparency and forthright answers for timely corrections. Statutes. In the interpretation of the statutes levying taxes, it is the established rule not to extend their provisions by implication beyond the clear import, again specificity, of the language used, or to enlarge their operations as to embrace matters not specifically pointed out. In the case of doubt, they are construed most strongly against the government and in favor of the citizen. So even the citizen is protected. Supreme Court, 1917, fairly close to passing of the 16th Amendment, fairly close to the Income Tax Act and all that, so they ought to know what they're talking about. Agents appear to willfully misinterpret the regulations. Power to issue regulations is not power to change the law. That's another one, in addition to whatever we addressed regulations before. And predatory administrative technicalities, we call those. In adopting its rules and regulations, an administrative agency must act within the Constitution. Obviously, administrative agencies, like police officers, could not authorize violations of the Constitution, must obey the Constitution, and may not deprive persons of constitutional rights. All these cases now, once you hammer them like this, they seem to resonate in the same kind of direction, don't they? The hearings held at the FTB office are recorded proof, because we had, recorders, and we also had stenographers, of agents' disingenuous statements, exhibit so-and-so. We have that whole thing, and it's a thick pack, about their authority. The records also show the lack of agents' cooperation to provide any opportunity for me to cross-examine, again, another third punch on cross-examination, their purported evidence. And we chose for the cross-examination. On the other hand, this is another case. On the other hand, the presentation of evidence by affidavit is common practice at administrative hearings for agencies under the Administrative Procedures Act. Okay. Affidavits may serve as direct evidence if no request to cross-examine is made. We made, in our letters to them, requests for cross-examinations. They did not ask for cross-examination. They just offered some, they accepted to have a hearing as long as we bring more proof. We specifically said, if you do not plan on providing evidence for our cross-examination, there's no reason for us to come to this hearing. Well, they said, okay, come to the hearing. They gave us a date. We went to the hearing, and there was no cross-examination because there was nobody to cross-examine. Okay? Under this standard, affidavits by persons as to facts within their personal knowledge would qualify as competent evidence, provided the opposing party's right to cross-examine is fully protected. That's what we asked for. We asked for the person that can to be there, the person that established a state liability first, before we would have personal liability, because there are other things that you would know from the other. Again, from the other exhibits, that's prerequisite to having a liability that they can act upon, the Franchise Tax Board. And so we asked for us to provide the opposing party's right to cross-examine. We asked for that, and it's fully protected. That's the case. Okay, I'm done with that. And purported evidence. They say, well, we have evidence we don't have to show you. When there is an innocent explanation for a defendant's conduct, as well as one that suggests that the defendant was engaged in wrongdoing, that's what they're saying, well, you're trying to interfere with this, the government must produce evidence that would allow a rational jury to conclude beyond a reasonable doubt that the latter explanation is the correct one. Good. It is this very evidence that brings us to the notice and demand. If it were up to us, we wouldn't do the notice and demand if we had a choice. The reason for the notice and demands, reiterated here briefly, is to establish a pattern in their behavior of dishonor. Number two, since the world is a stage and the court is also a stage, and the better a show you put on that stage, if it so happens that these agents that, let's say, they don't heed to our advice to, you know, back off a little bit because you're stepping on my toe, we may find ourselves in court scenario, like we addressed before, to defend ourselves. Well, under that scenario, what if one of these agents wants a jury trial? In a common law court, while as a plaintiff you still have control over the court to some degree, the judge may play on the ignorance of the jury and may disallow some evidence. There are, we can go over that, and Bill actually could go over that in section, in stage two, which is the common law procedures. But just to anticipate that move, if we're the plaintiff and we say, hey, on such and such day I wrote you this letter, and that letter is the notice and demand. That very first letter is one of the most powerful letters because it has the key elements of jurisdiction. It has the key elements addressed in A and B and several others. But the jury may be bored. They don't want to read all that. So we try to do the strongest, most honest and apparent punches in 1, 2, and 3. And this is more technical because this is supposed to reach their attorneys. What we're hoping to achieve with this notice and demand, we're hoping that we never have to go to court. That's the purpose of this fourth one, to be most complex so that they get a whiff of what we've learned. And if it gets kicked upstairs, the guys are going to look, hey, what does that exhibit look like? So they go back and they respond 6 months later, say, you know, let this one go or something, because this may end up costing us a lot of money. All right. So, and the third purpose is in writing these letters to these amicable love fans, we are indirectly educating them on some issues that they may not be educated. Let's give them the benefit of doubt. When you take up a job with the FTB or IRS, you're hungry just like all of us are when we're unemployed. So if someone's got to collect taxes, why not me? So they go there and they get, okay, this is all you do. This is your cubby hole, and this is the form. You receive this. If it doesn't match, don't bother. Someone else. Someone's been there a year. If it doesn't match it here, someone's been there for 3 years. By the time it gets to the ninth level, it's a time-consuming process. That's why if you hit them with this one, boom, from the very beginning, you're not going to get, first of all, the disclosure officer to respond to you right away because you have not established a history that you could now, in case of a jury, show that they have that they follow a pattern of some sort. And I had a question at a break that I was going to address in this situation. Made a mental note. The issue being that would this stop? Is this meant to stop everything at the administrative level? And yes, this is meant to stop at the administrative level. Hopefully, not having to go into court. Okay. All right. So we're hoping that it has the power. Then,
Mark, what would you get that says we're done with this? You're okay. They would send you something?
Well, we would accept. Well, let me do this. Can you write that question down and write it at the end after I'm done? Ask me that question because I'm hoping that it'll be answered as I go down.
Is this line. Suitable?
Well, if it's not used, yes.
Always in trouble.
I can only reason that agents are acting in concert under color of office. So now we're making them aware that the way they're acting, it may have some consequences. And this is the part that gets sent upstairs. I can only reason that agents are acting in concert under color of office. What does that mean? Imagine yourself now, you're an agent. You receive this and you read this color of office. Pretense of official right to do an act made by one who has no such right. He thinks he has the right, right? Okay, an act under color of office is an act of an officer, he is an officer, who claims authority to do the act by reasons of his office when the office does not confer on him any such authority. Now again, maybe we're dealing with more than 104 IQ. Maybe he or she knows that, wait a minute, you know, I think I'm doing the right thing here. This does not affect me. I'm not going to pay any attention. Okay. In such manner as to entrap me in some administrative scheme. What does that mean? So let's say that one didn't stop him. No. For the purposes of this chapter, the term scheme or artifice to defraud includes a scheme or artifice to deprive another of the intangible right of honest services. Oh, uh-oh. You mean he's asking me to respond to this? So now I should be able to relate, you know, no matter what my IQ, that an honest service would mean I better answer to this. If I'm not capable, well, maybe I should pass it to someone. So that's usually typically more typically what happens with more complex letters. Through relentless and unfounded presentments under color of law. Now that one is the appearance or semblance without the substance of legal right. Misuse of power possessed by virtue of state law and made possible only because the wrongdoer is clothed with authority of state, is action taken under color of law. Agents' notices and proposed assessments reflect a desire to use delay tactics for the apparent reasons of charging interest and unlawfully keeping the fruits of my labor. Remember, we were talking about the fruits separated from activity in the beginning. We addressed that issue. And live at my expense. Such tactics also appear as a convenient way to hide agents' negligence or fraud. Negligence, is that an excuse? Well, where one of two innocent persons must suffer by the act of a third, he by whose negligence has happened must be the sufferer. California Civil Code 3543. Or fraud, I wonder what that is, because it was addressed in that Supreme Court earlier, and it said any action again in common law against human rights is the definition of fraud. Well, let's see what this says. An intentional perversion of truth for the purpose of inducing another in reliance upon it to part with some valuable thing, like my paycheck, belonging to him, or to surrender a legal right, a false representation of a matter of fact, whether by words or by conduct, by false or misleading allegations, or by concealment of that which should have been disclosed, which deceives and is intended to deceive another so that he shall act upon it to his legal injury. And we're going to wrap our arms around that and embrace it and use it on the next page. Yes, again, again, and again, and again, to where they cannot say, oops, I didn't see that one. Due to both agents' actions and lack of actions, the administrative process has been exhausted. Now this is our decree. Based due to everything that we've placed so far, due to both agents' actions and lack of actions, the administrative process has been exhausted. That's where we draw the line. Then, a segue to why everything they have done is actually an injury. The makers of our Constitution undertook to secure conditions favorable to the pursuit of happiness. They recognized the significance of man's spiritual nature, of his feelings, and of his intellect. They sought to protect Americans, it doesn't say citizens, taxpayers, or anything, in their beliefs, their thoughts, their emotions, and their sensations. That's a lot of consideration for, you know, don't touch my hair, I may feel offended. They conferred, as against the government, the right to be let alone. The most comprehensive of rights and the right most valued by civilized men. How's that? Supreme Court, 1990. Wow. Citing 1928, which means, hey, 1928 as valuable, 1990. They're in a handshake agreement. California Constitution, Article 1, Declaration of Rights. All people are by nature free and independent and have inalienable rights. Among these are enjoying defending life and liberty, acquiring, possessing, and protecting property, and pursuing and obtaining safety, happiness, and privacy, constitutional liberty of freedom, such freedom as is enjoyed by the citizens of a country or state under the protection of its constitution, the aggregate of those personal, civil, and political rights of the individual which are guaranteed by the Constitution and secured against invasion by the government or any of its agencies. 1991. All subjects over which the sovereign power of a state extends are objects of taxation, but those over which it does not extend are upon the soundest principles exempt from taxation. This resonates with the citizen is exempt. Remember that Supreme Court earlier? The sovereignty of a state extends to everything which exists by its own authority or is introduced by its permission. Okay? Injuries. Good. Before we go to injuries, any questions up to this point?
Isn't that McCulloch, M.C.?
McCulloch, M.C.?
It's possible. I will look it up. Thank you for bringing that up. I'm going to put a question mark right here, right now, just to make sure. Okay, question mark. There we go. Thank you very much. Okay, I'll get some computer classes here. I'll trade you. All right. Good. So if we don't have any questions, then here are the injuries. And Bill, did you want to go over these injuries? Or you want me to just read them, and if they have questions, you address. Okay, it says I'm doing pretty good, so I'll keep going. Here's what we came up with. Everything that we said above established basically these injuries. Because agents exceeded their authority, I'm a hurt, whoever that might be, have suffered the following injuries. Loss of the amount over withheld. Those people that claimed Pete Hendrickson's whatever, they claimed over withheld. Did they send them back? Maybe some, maybe they didn't. Okay. Those are still lost. They're in their possession, which agents have not returned in the amount of whatever it may be. Okay? So you add year after year after year, 4 years to 2000 or whatever, respectively. And I suggest here subtotal, because the grand total comes at the end. Okay? So subtotal so-and-so. You can put total and then add them all up. Two, time spent for so many years to prepare and reply, estimated to be so many hours at so much per hour, subtotal of so much money. Legal and paralegal consulting costs, total of so much. Anguish, well, they were talking about the Constitution, protects Americans, their feelings, their whatever. Anguish is a feeling, right? We just read about it. That's why I put it so close to injuries. Legal and paralegal consulting costs. I mean, anguish, loss of sleep, and physical health. I didn't sleep last night. Okay. Amount of damages to date, so much. And you can put, I guess, anything you want there, Bill? Well, reasonable, as long as you can convince the jury, right?
Yeah.
If there's no jury, well, you're king. You can get away with it. Five, financial hardship. Yeah? It is financial hardship. Let's see what that means. Deprivation of rights under color of law. Whoever under color of law, of any law, statute, ordinance, regulation, or custom, willfully subjects, remember that word, willfully, any person in any state, territory, commonwealth, possession, or district to the deprivation of any rights, privileges, see, rights come first, privileges, or immunities secured or protected by the Constitution or laws of the United States, shall be fined under this title or imprisoned for any term of years or for life or both, or maybe sentenced to death. Okay. All right. So. Yeah, that's 18 U.S.C. Yeah, I thought I should have that there. I mean, how does that match with their ending paragraph there? 20,000 1 year. Well, guess what? I have it. Maybe sentenced to death. Now, is this threatening? No, because we don't say it. It's 18 U.S.C. that says it. Yes. And then interference with the pursuit of happiness. The constitutional right of men to pursue their happiness means the right to pursue any lawful business or vocation. How about that? In any manner not inconsistent with the equal rights of others, which, in other words, my punch stops before it hits your nose, which may increase their prosperity or develop their faculties so as to give them their highest enjoyment. So the Constitution is to protect our highest enjoyment. We're the kings of the land. We hire these people to do a job, and they take it upon themselves to trespass. That's a Supreme Court case, by the way. And it's a 1979, if you look down there. Okay. Financial hardships, happiness, whatever. So, duty. The duties for agents are codified in the United States. So now we're going down the list that Bill has addressed in the beginning. What should be put in the notice and demand. Everything up until injuries was point one of that list. Now we're going to point two. Is the injuries. Point three is the duties. The duties for agents are codified in the United States codes, California Penal Code, Civil Code, Business and Professions Code, California Government Code. Here where we readdress what we started the letter with, the notice and demand, that it is they have a duty to communicate with one another, especially if they're not the receiving party or the respondent, the respondent superior. All principals are responsible for agents' exercise of their duties. Notice to agent is notice to the principal. Notice to the principal is notice to agents. It's being quoted as such, but we also added something else here. California Civil Code. It says that as against the principal, both principal and agent are deemed to have notice of whatever either has notice of. And what do? Notice and demand. And ought in good faith and the exercise of ordinary care and diligence to communicate to the other. And this is the same citation we gave in the beginning. So they cannot, if they missed it the first time because they didn't know what a footnote looks like, well, they have it now. All government agents are public employees and are duty-bound by contract to the oath of office. The constitutional provision makes no distinction, listen to this, in the necessity of the oath as between public officers and employees. So, to some degree, that's what Bill was saying. They're agents, right? Where they're dealing with the public. They can't say, look, I'm not an agency, whatever, because you're a public officer, an employee. That's a cheap excuse. You're an employee in some kind of public interaction. So right there, I'd say they really don't have a strong argument. The execution, yeah, no problems. The execution of the oath is essential to the status of the de jure employment, the lack of which precludes the right to compensation for services rendered. Which means you can't get paid unless you have that oath of office. It's pretty clear. And that's what establishes the fiduciary duty, which we have a fiduciary duty to pay that too for their support. But we have that duty only if they stay within the boundaries of that which they are supposed to do. The moral question would be, what if the agent is new and it really doesn't know and you slap him with a notice and demand like this? Well, that's why we're saying here, just in case it lands in someone new and we say agents must communicate, you take it to that whoever is your superior, and we're asking for that person. We're still chasing who is responsible for these injuries at this point. That's why we're going after the agents rather than the agency, because we cannot presume the agency has policies that are unconstitutional unless they prove us wrong. Agents have a moral, lawful, and legal duty to exercise proper diligence to verify their policies. That's what I think, and this is my law now. They have a legal, lawful, and moral duty to exercise proper diligence to verify their policies. Do not infringe upon long-standing principles and constitutionally protected rights. Am I alone in saying that? Well, let's see. This great principle that the Constitution and the laws made in pursuance thereof are supreme, that they control the Constitution and laws of the respective states and cannot be controlled by them. From this, which may be almost termed an axiom, the ultimate truth, other propositions are deduced or as corollaries related to. That a power to create implies a power to preserve. That a power to destroy, if wielded by a different hand, is hostile to and incompatible with these powers to create and to preserve. And three, that where this repugnancy exists, the authority which is supreme must control, not yield to that over which it is supreme. Now, who's supreme in California?
The people.
All right. Yes. There's McCulloch. Okay, so it got transferred, got chopped off. Thank you very much for pointing that out. Good. It's right there, McCulloch. We had some hands raised. Yes. Bill, would you mind taking that?
I need to rest. So I guess my question is, since most of us get notices from field agents, regional agents, I actually have done some mailings in the past to the chief counsel of the FTB, because they're the ones that are legally going to be responsible for rebuttal or for the position of the law. So would it be wise to mail the FTB chief counsel and CC the agents, or has anyone tried that strategy?
Where is the chief counsel?
Rancho Cordova. There, it's similar to the IRS chief counsel, because once you notify them, you know, they're the ones that have to deal with lawsuits and everything. So it's actually, it kind of skips the middleman and goes right for the main guy who's legally responsible for the position of the agency. So I was just wondering if anyone has tried that.
Well, you're already in the suit when they're suing you, right?
No, there's no legal suit. They've just ignored it. It's just notices back and forth. But I've actually done notification to the chief counsel before of the Franchise Tax Board. So,
all right. It was your initiative that you notified the chief counsel, not the chief counsel making the first move against you.
Right, exactly. I was asking for a determination as to my status.
Okay, and then he's the one who makes the determination.
Right.
Right. Well, that's the one you would send the notice and demand to then.
Okay.
That's what I would do.
No.
Just act like the rest.
That's
how they got the job.
Okay.
We did that.
Whoever I initially sent the the response for the determination to chief counsel.
Okay. I'll be there in a few minutes.
You might have to.
How are we doing there?
Doing pretty good. Yeah, time wise will be good for questions.
Okay, Bill, could you clarify something?
Yes.
On Michael's question.
Yes.
Who would be the initial person to contact? Would it be the response to the agent and then a copy to the chief counsel, or chief counsel with a response to the agent, or a copy to the agent?
I always like to deal with the people that deal with me. You know, I find out what their name is, and sometimes you have a problem when you try to get a hold of these people. You know, they send out unsigned letters and this type of thing. So what you do is you call up and you ask the logical question. Who pushed the button, you know, for this computer letter? Who's responsible? And, of course, they might not tell you. And that's fine, because you still make the record of the call. Then what you do is you ask who his boss is, who's in charge of that. And the middle management is reluctant to tell you, but that's okay. If they won't tell you, you ask, well, who's the boss of the boss? Yeah. And at some point, you end up at, if necessary, whoever the top boss is. I mean, if you have to go all the way up to the commissioner, the IRS commissioner, well, then that's what you do. But you find somebody who's responsible, and you target that person, and the only way he can get off the hook is to then give you the information, or else he's the blocking point. Do I have time to tell him a little related story on that?
Right ahead.
A friend of mine was suing Security First National Bank before it had merged with Bank of America, and they had a multi-story high-rise building down in downtown Los Angeles. And he was having precisely that problem. There was somebody inside the bank that was, he wanted to get the name of the person because they committed the action of some kind, and they absolutely blocked him. They wouldn't tell him. And they wouldn't even respond to reasonable requests, letters, or whatever. And he went right up the chain of command and got no names, and he finally went to the chairman of the board. Okay? And he did it through the court. He had a case going. And so he had to serve the chairman of the board this information. Now, this friend of mine was very, very diplomatic. On the website, I always suggest to you that you always make friends with everybody. You treat your enemy like your friend. You know, you don't turn your back on them, but still you have courtesy, you know. And this friend of mine was extremely diplomatic. He would have been a perfect diplomat. And so he went up to Los Angeles from Orange County to serve the chairman of the board of Security First National Bank. And they let him up. He went all the way to the top floor, right up to the top floor, went in. He told the secretary that he was here and he had to serve his papers. So his brother was with him because his brother would be the process server. So they go into the chairman's office, and in his diplomatic fashion, he apologized. He says he realized that the chairman is very busy with the affairs of the company, but he was here because he simply had no choice. He was the point of contact in order to get this. And so the chairman was very diplomatic too. And he said, well, tell me what's going on here, you know. And so he kind of told him the story of what it was about, the efforts he went through and so forth. And after a little bit, he said to the chairman that, well, he had to go now because he had to drive out from downtown L.A. to Santa Monica. So the chairman said, well, come with me. So they're on the top floor, right? And they go upstairs. And they get in his helicopter. And they fly over to Santa Monica, and they get out of the helicopter, and there's two limousines there, one for the chairman and one for them. And they get in the limousine, which takes them to the attorney's office. And when they get there, there is one very, very angry attorney waiting in the doorway for them to show up. And so they serve this attorney, who obviously he had to accept the service. And then the limousine took him back to the helicopter, which flew him back to the top of the building. They validated his parking, and he went, and they returned to Orange County. I don't know. Well, anyway, this actually happened. It was a phenomenal story. But it shows what you can do with diplomacy. Not everybody's your enemy. And, you know, to the chairman of the board. Now, I want you to understand something, that it's understood that when you're on that high a level of management, whether it's a company or a country, you always treat the other leader as a friendly equal, okay? I mean, you leave the peons to battle it out with their armies, and naturally you try to win. But when you're on a personal level, you always are very friendly toward each other. In fact, during World War II, when we captured one of the enemy, I forget who it was now. I think it was Patton, maybe. Anyway, he actually put the opposing general in jail. And that was just beyond his belief. He couldn't believe that the American general would do that, you know. And in ancient times, whenever they had wars, the nobility always treated each other well. Sure, they might have been technically captured, but they were trustworthy in the sense that they knew diplomatic relations. And that's what you do when you're in court. You try to be diplomatic and everything. You still make your points, just like we're doing here, but you're friendly. Anyway, those are little war stories I thought you'd like. Well, he eventually got him settled. I mean, he had to sue. Well, he caught them in a lot of legal technicalities. He was not using our system, however. He was going the customary route, but he was handling his own case. And he was a very intelligent man. I mean, this guy did his research well, and he also cross-linked information well. So he did very well in it.
All right, almost there. So where did we leave? Oh, yeah. Agents have a moral, lawful, and legal duty to exercise proper diligence to verify their policies, not to infringe upon longstanding principles and constitutionally protected rights. Agents may not act against people. The enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. This is the 9th U.S. Constitution, 9th Amendment. That pretty much says it all. The enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. What did they do? Well, they turn around this and they use it against us now. Right. They're saying, well, you know, here are you have to prove that we don't have this right. Well, I don't think so. So as to, okay, So they can't say that against the people, so as to effectively change their duty into injury. Their duties are not to injure. So one must not change his purpose to the injury of another. California Civil Code, Section 3512. So what we did, we weaved these codes into a speech pattern, if you want, a speech format that makes sense. All agents have a duty to know and follow the laws which bind them and should be held accountable to the highest standards of professional conduct. Administration should be both reasonable and vigorous. It should be conducted with as little delay as possible, as which great courtesy and with great courtesy and consideration. It should never try to overreach and should be reasonable within the bounds of law and sound administration. The codes, that's FDB mission statement. Yeah.
That's their statement?
Yeah. FDB codes. Although agencies must be able to change, because they say, well, we got to put up the times, it's far too complex now for you bums out there, we'll figure it all out for you and we'll tell you what to do. Although agencies must be able to change to meet new conditions arising with their sphere of authority, any expansion of agency jurisdiction must come from Congress and not the agency itself. Why are we addressing Congress? Because we have already identified that they're talking about a federal income tax. So Congress has to deal with that. Okay, so the codes disallow harmful acts. Okay. That means California Civil Code, Section 3520, says no one should suffer by the act of another. That pretty much disallows a harmful act, such as conspiring to extort, misrepresent, deceive, or conceal critical information. Conspiracy against rights. If two or more persons conspire to injure, oppress, threaten, or intimidate any person in the state, we've read this already, or district in the free, whatever, okay, sentenced to death. In order to perpetuate error, well, that's 18, I just quote, 18 U.S.C. Section 241. Yeah, those are there already. They're yours. Once you download this, you'll have this in your computer. So in order to perpetuate error for the purpose of gain, California Civil Code, Section 3512, no one can take advantage of his own wrong. Section 1986, okay, it's right there. I mean, okay, Section 1986 of the Civil Code also disallows failure to act in such ways which would prevent injury to anyone. California Civil Code 3519. He who can and does not forbid that which is done on his behalf is deemed to have bidden it. Okay, you didn't stop it. You're in it. You stepped in it. Or you stay in your sandbox.
Section, was it 1983 that says a similar thing?
We're getting there. Yeah. No problem. Yes, it is. It's expressed in many, many ways and from different perspectives. So, because like I said, we're trying to put a little brick here, a little brick there, and they don't see them as we're building a wall. And there's one brick there, and they just kick it, and they hurt a little bit, but no big deal, no threat. And then we add bricks, and eventually there's only this exit. And that exit was 7851, and I'll address that in the end. We'll address that in the end. I believe agents are breaching their oath of office, authority, jurisdiction, and duty. What could that be? Certain wrongs affect more than a single right, and accordingly can implicate more than one of the Constitution's commands. Where such multiple violations are alleged, which I think we're kind of doing, we are not in the habit of identifying as a preliminary matter that claims dominant character. Rather, we examine each constitutional provision in turn. So, they're supposed to, and that's a Supreme Court there, what they're going to do is if we end up in a situation to go to court, they're not going to just look at one. They're going to look at each and every one of them. And maybe they may even come up with multiple violations. Okay, which is what we would like. By dishonoring, I believe they are breaching jurisdiction and duty. By dishonoring their burden to prove their claims. 19180 section, which we cited before, in any proceedings or not, any person is liable for whatever, the burden of proof is, respect to that issue, shall be on the Franchise Tax Board. That's why we feel that they dishonored that burden of proof.
19180.
Is that breach right? There's two ways.
I'm sorry, did I misspell something? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Thank you. I'm sorry? No. Yeah, my hands must have been shaking. Okay. You ask a question, Bill. You wanted to know that is... 19180 is a revenue and taxation code. Yes. Franchise Tax Board. By failing to provide the requested information, which was essential for timely corrections of errors and elimination of unnecessary administrative harassment. 127. The people in delegating authority do not give their public servants the right to decide what is good for the people to know and what is not good for them to know. California Government Code. By failing to provide the requested information, which we claimed all along. By unjust enrichment from the fruits of my labor, a violation of constitutional protected right, which we already addressed in the beginning, the fruits versus actions. By capriciously disregarding my sworn affidavits and my verified evidence, while arbitrarily denying my refunds. And here we slap them with all these that we did not address yet, all these exhibits. Based on presumptions which hold no legal weight. Excuse me. It was said that wherever a man does not act, which in law and in fact is a wrongful act, and such an act as may, as a natural and probable consequence of it, produce injury to another, and which in the particular case, in this particular case, does produce such an injury, an action on the case will lie. We're letting them know that now pretty much they expose themselves to an action on the case. When we go into common law or a court of record, we do a trespass on the case. That's what this stands for, an action on the case. Right? By mailing uncertified and verified solicitations and unfounded penalties. Okay, it has been long established that a state may not impose a penalty upon those who exercise a right guaranteed by the Constitution. What have we done? We asked questions. Did they respond? No. By assuming jurisdiction and continuing to act under color of office and color of law, which we already established and defined, by unlawfully collecting garnishments and processing unfounded liens and levies, okay, where administrative action may result in loss of both property and life. We already addressed that, but we reiterate it here, so we readdress it. Yes, we have a question on this. You have a question?
Yes, the garnishments.
Yes.
As I understand it, the banks and employers, the payroll departments,
yes,
receive only, for instance, a notice of a levy, and they themselves are responsible for taking your money and handing it over. No pressure was put on them. They just delivered under this color.
Right. For the tape's sake, were you able to hear?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Okay. Yes, that is accurate, but we are not burdened by proving them wrong or right. We want to know if that is a modus operandi, and how do we respond to that without putting ourselves in jeopardy?
I thought maybe the idea was we should include them in the action.
As
defendants. They're guilty, too.
They participated in it also.
I think the
garnisher.
Okay, we have a suggestion. We have a suggestion. The microphone.
Back there. I think what Bill was saying earlier is that we're in a court and we're putting on a pitch or a show, and to add a company as defendants. They're under the same pressure, and I'm just speaking from my own personal experience. Owning your own company, you're under the same pressure as an individual to pay taxes and obey the Internal Revenue Service. Because just as quick as they can put their hands in your pockets, it's the same with the corporation. If you don't abide by their rules, they'll take over your bank account. So they're under the same
duress
as an individual. So
yes. Besides, it splits the attention to some side issue, okay? Right. Also opens up the door of breaking up relationships with maybe a good position Why jeopardize that when, in fact, that employer was he or she themselves under duress? So let's not attack them. If they're being misinformed, would only be because of their misconstruing, misdoing. And besides, when we send the first notice and demand, we address that issue. And we say, hey, it appears you received these funds or whatever, and you're hereby notified that those are not taxable, and for some reason the employer was misled to send it to you, and maybe he made some statements to you, but please verify. I would like to see the verification that what you hold in your hand is actually a verified testimony that what he paid me is taxable income. And if you look at the issues of withholding agents or who's authorized to really withhold those wages or income, and it gets really complex, which we don't want to open that door again. Doesn't really make sense to go into those details and trigger unnecessary, because they are the ones stepping out of line when we summons them. Hey, there might be some error. You verify before you come to me. Yes.
I can see. Okay. So it's not to split the focus of this.
Right.
But I pointed out to the payroll department at the time anyway that they were not obligated, that the IRS had not sent them any real law. They, what's that, 668 A and B? Mm-hmm. They only gave them part B. They didn't say to whom it applied. So I pointed that out to them.
Yeah. Yes, and they went ahead. 6331A you're talking about was missing on that, yes.
Yeah, I think that the company deserves every bit of a biggest hit as these guys for going along with it. They're Quislings. But for this purpose, we shouldn't do it. I agree.
Okay. Any comments? Bill.
As a general rule, my rule of thumb is that I don't sue people who are stupid. Okay, and I don't sue people because of a genuine accident. You know, we can always second guess certain things and say, well, you should have done so and so. And, you know, bank tellers, their IQ is the same on average as the IQ of a cop, which is the same as an IQ of a secretary. These are not the thinkers of our society. And they just follow the rules, and they just do whatever they're doing. In the case of cops, maybe there's a touch of meanness. But basically, you can create a lot of work for yourself by suing the wrong people. And so, because if they answer, now you have to reply to the answer, and ultimately you have to take all that into account. So you try to target the key problem area, and the rest will fall in place if you get the right ones. Managers are excellent at telling their employees to lay off of you, you know, if they think they're paid. You want to get them to feel the pain, and that means, when I say feel the pain, what I mean is you want them to feel that their paychecks are threatened. And a lawsuit, I always like to do a personal lawsuit as well. Whenever I have a problem with a public official, I go after them personally. Why do I do that as a strategy? Is because one of the things that's really difficult to prove is that it's their policy to do something. When it's the state's policy, then you have access to the state's deep pockets. Okay? If you go after the state is going to say, oh, no, that's not our policy. He acted on his own. You should have sued him. And, of course, by the time you get through all that, statute of limitations gets in the way. Of course, I realize there's no statute of limitations in common law, but nevertheless, these become barriers. So what I do is I sue the individual, and then the state steps in and protects them. And says he was just doing his job and you shouldn't have sued him. He's got immunity, okay? And so I say, well, thank you very much. I'm glad to know that's your policy, okay? By their own admissions. And also, their suit, if they sue you first, you do not have to go through risk management or through, what do they call that, court of claims, okay? You don't have to go through them because they already started the trouble. Okay? If you initiate the suit, you need to go through the 60-day process. Now, in common law, you really don't have to. But I play along as long as I don't lose my rights. You know, it makes it really easier because there's some rules they do understand and they follow. Anyhow, that's my 2 cents worth on that. There was a question back here.
Yeah, my situation, some court took place. I don't know what was going on with it, but basically they sent collections out to the state of California. I've seen the letter they gave to the bank. This is funny. They took $117 from me. The bank charged $100 to do it. They sent $17 to the judgment, basically.
Sure.
And basically, I seen the letter that they gave us. Nobody signed it to give them the authority to take the money out of the bank account. So who do you go after in that case? Do you go after that collection agency? Is some collection agency for the state of California, for Sacramento?
Well, first of all, you have to understand what a signature is. Okay, if you look at the Uniform Commercial Code, which under common law you're not obligated to it. But I did some research for the Ohio Supreme Court 1 year. And specifically, I dealt with the issue of signatures. And my research showed me that a signature is anything you choose to make it, any symbol you use. And so you could type it. If you say that's your signature, it is your signature. Okay? And also under the California Evidence Code, if you make a copy of your original document, that copy is an original. If you, the originator, say it's an original, even if it's a copy, it must be accepted as a copy. Yes, that's in the evidence code. Okay? Pardon?
What if their lawyer, their attorney states?
What if they're original? Well, if the attorney is representing his client, he can speak for his client, and if his client originated the document, then he can say that the copy is an original. Sure. Yeah, you know, you can have an agent speak for you. And that's what an attorney is.
The question is, who do you sue?
Yeah, who do you go after?
Who do you go after? Well, you always go after the perpetuator of some problem. And again, like I described before, you try to find out who originated that letter. If it's unsigned, unnamed, you know, then you try to find out. You make a phone call. Now, phone calls don't mean anything in themselves. Yeah, you make up a history, you kind of keep track, but really this is a paper game. But it's useful sometimes to call on the phone and interview people, ask them who did what and so forth, and you run into these barriers, you make a note of the barrier. But ultimately, you may end up with the chief, okay? Because the chiefs always like to let people know they're in charge. So you just go on the internet, you can easily find out who the commissioner of the IRS is or who's head of the FTB. You can't find out, you'll end up at his office, as like I mentioned in my prior story.
Okay, I have a question for you. In Washington, a gentleman worked for a company. The IRS sent a notice of levy and lien, blah, blah, blah. I won't go into what the numbers were, but and they took, over a period of 4 months, 100% of his wages.
Sure.
Now, the company sent the wages to the IRS. The IRS did not send it to the employee. They sent it to the company. The company then garnished the wages. So my question is, who do you sue?
Well, by my own policies, I would sue the IRS. I'd go after them. I wouldn't really bother the bank unless I got a sense of it that they have a streak of meanness also.
Well,
you know, I go for the troublemakers.
Yeah.
I don't go for the people who are operating under the cloud of fear, you know, because they're afraid of the IRS even more than you are.
Well, I sent them a letter, I sent them an opinion letter, an attorney opinion letter,
sure,
expressing what the problems were, and I understood that they were fearful. I explained the law to them.
I detailed
it out, and they're still afraid. And they still did nothing.
Well, no. Well,
and I even wrote them a letter to ask the IRS
hold on a second,
determination.
Hold on. You can always find somebody to get mad at, okay? That's no problem at all.
Oh, okay,
and they come out of the woodwork. But sure. Don't think that they're coming out of the woodwork because they personally want to do you harm. Look, these people are afraid of the IRS. They don't even have an inkling of what we know.
Of course.
Okay? So they operate under pure fear of the IRS. The IRS is a do-all and be-all to those people. So, you know, you have to have a little bit of kindness in what you're doing. That, sure. Those bankers live in an artificial world. They're doing what they're doing. I'm talking about the ordinary person. I'm not talking about the big thinkers who figure out sophisticated crimes, okay? Mm-hmm. I'm talking about the ordinary banker, the corner bank. These guys, they're trying to make a living too. To them, the fictitious money is real money to them. So,
well, I sent a letter to the CFO and the CEO of the company. So.
Yeah, but well, there was a congressional hearing, okay? And they had one of the top thinkers, somebody who really knew what was going on there. And they asked him, you know, how did the Federal Reserve get started? And they said, well, they did a book entry of $50 million. There was no real money. They just made it $50 million. That's how they capitalized it. And so anyway, the congressman asked him, he says, well, do the bankers understand this, speaking of the people who were in management? And the man replied, he says, not one in 500 understands it. Okay?
Right.
So you're dealing with massive ignorance. You're dealing with people who do nothing but follow the trodden path. Okay? So you would
sue the agent that sent the letter?
I'd go after the agent, yes.
Okay.
The agent's supposed to be the competent point, although he may not necessarily be.
All right.
But nevertheless, he's the competent point, and you give him your notices, you give him the warnings, he ignores it, then you burn him, okay, with your lawsuit. You go after him and find out, you know, remember this, don't stop with just suing them. Look up their what property they might own. And put a preservation of interest on their property.
Or how do you find out if they're using a real name? Because the name looks as if it's not a real name.
Well, yeah, a lot of times they will assign a name by shift, what shift the letter was triggered on. But look, that's okay because somebody's in charge of that shift. All right?
Okay.
And if you can't find out who the shift supervisor is, then you find out who the general manager is. You can't find out him. Like I said, you go up the ladder until you find a name. And once you got that name, now you direct it to him and you want him to reveal the information. And if he doesn't, that's fine because now he's responsible.
Okay.
And I'll bet he owns a house.
Okay.
You see?
Yeah.
So you can, if you're patient, you can make the wheels of justice grind, even though they grind slowly. And you can make a lot of headaches for these people when they decide to join in the fight instead of helping in the fight.
You don't think, so to reiterate, you saying that you don't think it would be advisable on any level to sue a CFO or CEO if for nothing else to hold them accountable for what you already gave them.
No, I go to the minimum level, whatever it is.
All right.
You know, I try to keep it low and I try to keep down the number of defendants.
Okay.
Because, like I said, they come out of the woodwork and not necessarily with intent to do you harm. They think they're actually doing the right thing. It's up to you to educate them. And if it turns out that in the blatant face of the obvious, they decide, screw you, well, okay, I'll screw them too, you know.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
I'd like to address a little further what John just mentioned. I ran into the same situation with Midland National Life Insurance Company, who is my IRA fiduciary, and they received a in-show notice of levy from the IRS. Now, Dan Meter has a beautiful 32-page memorandum at law called the Relation Back Doctrine, which is available either online or I have it and I can email it over. But what it says is a notice of levy must have a proof of claim from a competent court of law in order to be valid, and if it doesn't, it is ultra vires null and void. And if Marine Midland accepted this without the proof of claim, they're guilty of fraudulent conversion. Now, in my particular case, they sent $138,000 of an IRA to the Treasury Department and charged me $52,000 in interest and penalties for a withdrawal I never authorized, and they stonewalled every attempt that I made to get that money back. Now, coincidentally, I got that $52,000 back recently on a class action suit against Midland National, which was unrelated to any IRS issue. So at least I got that part of my money back and can now go for interest on that money, plus the other now. But what John didn't mention is that according to the 1997 Taxpayer Relief Act, you are only allowed to take 15% per month in any garnishment of wages.
Well, look, you can always point to anomalies that have happened. There's always something, the errors that are made, and these people, again, they're walking a pathway that was taught to them, and they don't necessarily know what they're doing. And when you put it in front of them, they may not have the brain power to really understand it. You know, that's why they have attorneys. And that's why they throw things over the attorney. And as you know, even with training, attorneys themselves aren't that bright sometimes, okay? So these things are going to happen where it seems like nothing you do is going to get their attention. This is why I suggest that when you sue the individual. This is what seems to wake them up a little better.
In common law?
Well, sure, or whatever works.
Well, you know, are you recommending common law as opposed to equity or admiralty? Or
I'll stand by my statement, whatever works. Okay?
Okay.
Because, look, the common law is not everything. Okay?
No, I understand.
There's different ways. Sometimes you can do better with the equity law. And so I suggest you use it where it looks like it'll work.
You have to give us an example where it would be more effective?
This is what we call strategy, okay? This is not law. You have a whole plateful of techniques, and so you need to evaluate. I use attorneys, okay? I had a case recently. I went to an attorney. Why? Because they know procedure. I know the system and concepts. They know the procedures.
Right.
And if we merge the two, it's great. And I actually used a procedure to accomplish a certain end. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, so you have to be able, it's like a boxer. You have to be able to duck and bob where necessary. You can't teach somebody to always use the left hand to punch, because sometimes the right hand is useful, you know. So you have to learn your skill. Unfortunately, you have to become an attorney.
Do you find any value in Tim Turner's negative averment counterclaim suit in Admiralty?
First of all, a negative averment is nothing more than an affidavit that says something does not exist.
Right.
Okay?
I understand.
No facts exist until some human being will step forth and under penalty.
Well, he does a negative averment counterclaim opportunity to cure, and then his own remedy.
Well, isn't that what we're talking about here? We're just giving different titles to it, you know. So he has been very successful, so far as I know.
Correct. Yeah.
And so I would say that if he's got something that works, use it. You know?
I do, but I wondered if you did or had.
Yeah, well, if I have a strong foundation of ignorance about what he's doing. You know.
Okay.
There you go. Yeah, so I don't know. See, I don't know. But I have talked with him personally.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you this, that I said to Tim, I said, what would you do if everything you did was being ignored? You know you're right. You got the law on your side. You're doing everything. But you just happen to hit the group that really doesn't care. And they're willing to break the law to get in your way. I said, what would be the ultimate battleground short of revolution? Okay? And that's when he had to acknowledge, because there is that possibility. And what he's doing only works when people obey the law. But if you have a lawbreaker, you know, we outlawed robbery on the streets, but it still happens. Okay? Right. So we have robbers in banks too. So I gave him that proposition. I said, what would you do? And he didn't have anything beyond what his technique was. So, and besides, whatever he does, ultimately he relies on the judge to obey the law himself.
Except that I think, meaning to be adversarial, what he has done is move to Restore America plan to move into that.
That's a separate issue.
But that's his remedy when they break the law.
Well, that's a separate issue, though. You see, that. But what I'm getting at is that these things work only as long as people respect the system.
Sure.
When they disrespect the system, I don't care how right you are, if they have the guns, you're going to have a problem. Right. So, anyway, I put that question to him, and he could not provide anything other than the fact that he's staying out of the courts as much as possible. But if he does go to the court, he would be relying on the judge making the proper decision, which can happen. So I'm not saying that's not a...
And the judge makes them remove his liens.
Pardon?
The judge makes them remove his liens. They're frivolous.
Doesn't make him remove his liens. He hasn't. He tried it 13 times, and they have not been able to remove it. The lien stands at $50 billion. He's been offered $22.5 billion
But we don't have to get angry about it.
Oh, I don't mean to be angry. I just I apologize. I'm not angry about it. I just mean that.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Now, I pose the question to Tim.
Yeah.
And the best that Tim could come up with was that, well, he has a system, and if people obey the rules, fine. And if he had to go to court, his method, he would have to rely on the judge making the right decision or get it corrected on appeal if he makes the wrong decision. He was into that system. That was his only choice. So I pointed out to him that the court of record is the ultimate battleground. The Supreme Court itself has said, and it's on the website, that the decision of a court of record is as binding on the Supreme Court as the Supreme Court's decisions are binding on other courts. Okay? It is the highest court, and there is no appeal from a court of record's decision. So, to me, this is the ultimate battleground. And if you can't get a solution in the jury box, meaning the court of record, you have no system. Okay?
So, yeah.
But I have found that judges do respect it if you properly protect them, as I mentioned before. Yes. Do we need a microphone or something? And we need to also kind of cut this down and continue on with the program here.
I had seen a trial recently in San Francisco at Superior Court, and it was kind of a travesty because I had seen the judge disallow lots of pieces of evidence, mm-hmm. which were key to making their case.
That's why he disallowed it.
That's what concerns me, that the only method people who are challenging the IRS or the state, because it's a conglomerate, I think it's very mafioso. It covers too many agencies.
Yes.
The way to do it is through common law. Because if you can preserve your record and get your evidence in, then you have a chance of at least getting some type of result.
Well, I'll say this last comment and then turn it back over to the proper program here. But when you are in that situation, that is not a court of record. Okay? Now, a court of record is a superior court. That court is an inferior court. Even though it's called a superior court, it's actually an inferior court because it's not proceeding according to the rules required of a court of record. In other words, not common law. The magistrate is making decisions instead. And so what you do is, if you go through that whole process, sometimes a case gets so dirtied up by motions and counter motions and confusion and so forth, you'll never straighten it out. So what you do is you live with that decision. It goes, you got the decision, don't bother with an appeal. Okay? What you do is you start a brand new lawsuit, but this time in a court of record, which is a superior court. Now you go on the website and it tells you there, when you look at court of record, I think it's in that page, you'll see that there is a case where they explain that a superior court, which is a court of record, its proceedings have a presumption of validity unless the record shows otherwise. In an inferior court, it does not have a presumption of validity. It does not mean it's invalid. It just means that there's no presumption of validity. So a court that's inferior is of limited jurisdiction. Because it's limited jurisdiction, it can't necessarily make the right decision because it can't take in all the things. Like, you cannot have civil matters judged in a criminal court. You can't have criminal matters judged in a civil court. And yet there might be a close relationship if you could bring in all these facts. So in a court of record, you can bring in all the facts, the criminal and the civil aspect. And in fact, an idea I've kind of entertained is that when you get to the judgment and your court has made a determination of what's true and not true, you might be able to just simply forward that decision over to the criminal court. And because the decision is made in your court already, you can put down the sentence that this guy should go to jail for 30 days. So I've toyed with that idea. I think you can do it, but I haven't pushed it. But you see, you're going to have to understand that that it's an inferior court and it's subject to collateral attack. Or putting that in plain English, your superior court can sue not only the people that are involved, but you can also sue the court. Okay? And make them a defendant and have a trial de novo, meaning a new trial, and reassess everything in a brand new trial. Only you're the judge this time.
So you wouldn't open up the one that you just went through and reopened and make it a writ of error and all of those?
Well, you couldn't because you're the defendant in the other one. Or if you were the plaintiff, you were in a court, an inferior court.
Right.
You allowed the judge, whether you wanted to or not, you allowed the judge to make the decision.
Oh, I see.
And so this time, when you go through, you establish a court of record. And you
not double jeopardy?
No, that the government cannot prosecute you twice.
Okay.
But this is not prosecuting twice, because you see, that court, the inferior court, is not a genuine court. See, it's a court by agreement. Okay, you made an agreement to go to a lesser quality court. Yes. Okay. There's no such thing as a quick question. And we do need to get back to the program, but go ahead. All right. Push the switch up. Yeah, it sounds like a low battery.
I'm not capable of such sounds. But thank you.
Could just come up and use this mic, I guess.
I thought batteries included if I could tell.
Is that as loud as possible?
No. Stand by for battery recharge.
Battery's not included.
Yeah. Well, hold on. He's switching the battery. Soon you will have a great voice.
Can you sing the question?
Can you sing the question?
Yes. Hello?
Yep.
Okay.
You're on.
I'm on.
My question real quick, because my experience, I was just saying this. I don't know why would it be better to sue the little person as opposed to, let's say, the CEOs who is responsible for the company and is responsible for helping to continue the criminal act. And
you do.
So you do go after the CEOs.
You go after people who are responsible, okay,
right.
That you can directly attach. If you want to get into the effervescent stuff, you know, policy, mm-hmm. Where's your evidence of policy? How do you prove that that's their attitude? You see, it's very difficult. You're taking on a major challenge to prove that it's their policy. But if you sue the little guy, uh-huh. Separate from the corporate entity, the corporation very often will step right in and say, hey, he was just doing his job. You can't sue him. He has immunity. Okay, that's what the state will say. Okay. He was just doing his job. Well, what is that? That's a statement that he was doing what their policy dictates. Okay. Now you don't have to prove it because they admitted it.
Okay.
But if you attack them directly, they're going to take the opposite tack. They're going to say, well, usually you sue them and you don't sue the cops. See? So that what they'll do is they'll say, well, hey, we're not responsible. He acted beyond his authority.
Okay.
And so by the time you get all through that machinations, statute of limitations have run, and now he's immune from suit just purely for that reason. So it's best to let them jump in and admit that this is how we do things. There was a case indirectly related to this where the judge had noticed that the bank had broken the law. And he brought that up. He said to the attorney, the bank broke the law. And why did the bank do this? And the attorney replied, well, we don't do business that way. And the judge reiterated, and so did the attorney. He says, in the banking business, we don't do business this way. Well, needless to say, they lost that case. Okay, but this is their attitude. It's their policy. Okay, once you establish policy, you now have access to the deep pockets, but it's not something that you can easily prove. So are you a fighter or are you a winner? Okay, so if you want to be a winner, then you look for the shortest path to the goal. Don't go be anxious to start a fight on something that will cause you a lot of work. So let's get back to the subject at hand now. How long? 5 minutes?
Yeah.
Is that enough?
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay. Can we watch the clock and make sure it is 5 minutes?
Yeah.
Great. Thanks. Okay. It is
4:44.
4:44, huh?
See, I looked in your eyes and I knew the time.
4:44. Yeah. Good setup.